The year is 2040. Sea level is on the rise. By 2100, up to 70 million people could be impacted by flooding. We're seeing a lot fewer cold days. And a lot more hot ones. In 2040, as many as 750 million people living in cities will regularly deal with severe drought. That sounds pretty bad, right? Well, that's because the average global temperature has gone up by a whopping 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit since the Industrial Revolution. Without serious work by the international community, it's likely things will get much worse. Global temperatures could increase up to 3.6 degrees by the end of the century. And that means higher sea level rise, more heat waves and massive storms, likely no Arctic sea ice in the summer, and many more people living with little access to food and water. And the cost of dealing with a 3.6 degree increase, $64 trillion worldwide. These doomsday scenarios are not from a mega disaster Hollywood movie. It's according to a new report on climate change commissioned by the United Nations. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And today, one of the most important stories of our time that somehow keeps falling off the front page. Climate change. So let's talk about what happens next. We have two voices to help us with that. Megan Mullen is an associate professor of environmental politics at Duke University. Megan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. Hello.
And Mark Jacobson is a professor and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Mark, the first question for us non-scientists, does this report change our understanding of the speed and scope of climate-related dangers? Basically, I want to know, why don't more people care, Mark?
Well, I don't think it changes from the scientific point of view what we already knew. It just brings forward and makes it more public what a lot of scientists have known and really adds more detail. You know, people, I think, do care. A lot of people do care, but a lot of people just don't know what to do about it. And so that's part of what I try to do is try to make it easier for people to understand what they can do to try to solve the problem.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that from your perspective, Mark, is that when we were thinking about this, I thought, well, a lot of people are using paper straws, for example, and they're using nylon bags instead of plastic bags. Is that enough? Is that not enough? What are some of your solutions from a scientific perspective?
Well, most of the problem stems from too much emission from combustion, from burning things like oil, gas, and coal, and also even some biofuels and for energy. So we really need to change the energy infrastructure of the world to try to electrify everything. So instead of using gas heaters in our homes, we'd use electric heat pumps for air heating and water heating and air conditioning. So a lot of people can do a lot of things in their own lives to a transition, but what is also needed are policies put in place at the government level. And this is happening in a lot of places worldwide. I mean, California just passed a law that everything has to go to renewable energy in terms of their electric power by the year 2045, with 60% by 2030. And there are six countries of the world that run on almost 100% clean renewable energy already out of 195 countries of the world.
But we're going to take a look at some of those in a minute. But you mentioned policy, and that's where I want to bring in Megan here, because Megan, I think this is something that's become extremely politicized, this being climate change. Do we have any reason to believe that this report will actually result in change from our government, all the things that Mark just lined up, particularly when it comes to industry?
There are different governments, right? So it's hard to be optimistic that this will produce immediate change at the federal government level. But there are a lot of changes happening at the subnational level in the United States, in cities, in states. It's a difficult problem at the federal level. All of the barriers to solving political problems in the United States right now are more pronounced for climate change than for just about any other issue, right? The partisan differences on this issue are severe. The regional impacts of solutions are pronounced and variable. And there's not a large constituency of Americans right now for whom this is the most important problem to solve.
Now, I have to ask you there. This is an issue, as we just outlined at the beginning of the very top of the show, that will affect everyone, regardless of where you live and who you are. How is it that we continue to be in a disconnect, understanding that some of this is politically driven? But you just mentioned the natural disasters. I mean, these are things that have happened to all Americans, not just some Americans. Why are we still experiencing this disconnect? Has the politics really taken over to the point where we don't see a solution to this?
Well, it's difficult for people to connect their personal experiences, which, as you say, are happening right now, right? Eastern North Carolina, the western United States that's being impacted by fires, communities around the United States that are experiencing water scarcity or heat waves, right? So people are experiencing impacts right now, but it's difficult for them to connect those personal experiences with this abstract phenomenon.
Mark, when you hear Megan say that, I'm wondering how it looks to you as a scientist, why you think we haven't seen more political action towards climate change policies in this country.
I have a slightly different view because I agree that there is a disconnect when we talk about climate policy about what people want. In fact, there was a public opinion poll, large public international public opinion poll that says only 66% of people believe that climate change is a serious international problem. And that's pretty sad that only 66% believe that. However, the good news was over 82% of the people of the world, this was a poll of 26,000 people in 13 countries, believe that the world should transition to 100% clean renewable energy. So people do not necessarily believe in climate change, but they do believe in a transition to clean renewable energy. And you could even see that in the United States. I mean, 9 out of the 10 top wind states in the United States are all in Republican-led states. And there are over 80 cities and towns that have committed to 100% clean renewable energy. There are 140 international companies, including all the large companies of the world, have committed to that. So I think the key is not to talk about climate change. The reason people believe in clean renewable energy and not necessarily about climate change is because they think that clean renewable energy will create more energy independence, will reduce air pollution problems. People are more concerned about air pollution than they are about climate. It'll create more stable energy supplies in the long run. And also, it brings costs down. I mean, the two cheapest forms of new electric power in the United States today are onshore wind and large-scale solar power. And they're half the cost of natural gas. So the reason people are transitioning, despite their non-belief in climate change, is because it's cheaper and it's getting cheaper by the day.
But that appears to be, and continues to feel like a major disconnect between, you just mentioned, Mark, that Republican states are some of the ones that have the best wind and renewable energy resources right now. That seems very much in contrast, at least with what President Trump was saying, pumping up things like coal country, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. So he's talking a lot against it. But the fact is, because the economics are so good, people are transitioning in any case. Despite all his rhetoric, coal plants are still being shut down.
What about big business, Megan? I'm curious if you can help us understand that a little bit. Where do they play into this narrative about climate change?
Well, they exert a lot of influence on our politics, right? And the industry structure and our political structure is still favoring the businesses that have historically dominated the energy industry. And so in order to convert the sort of individual activities and the economic activities that Mark was describing before, in order to convert that into policy activity, then these businesses need to exert political voice. And so far, there's been some hesitation to do that.
Why is that?
I think a lot of it is that it is this sort of emerging industry, right? So there are lots of different players. It's not concentrated in a few actors. But that's part of what needs to happen, right? Exercising our voices and saying this is an issue we need you to prioritize, right? It's not just a concern, one of many, but it has to be the top concern for politicians looking to set their agendas, right?
And because we're not seeing many of them in the lead up to the midterm elections really putting this at the top of their agenda.
They're not, right? And right now, there's not a lot of political cost in ignoring it.
Mark, I'm wondering, we sort of touched on this, but I'm wondering what can everyday, average, non-governmental decision-making Americans do here? Those of us who are thinking we're doing the right thing by using the nylon bags and the plastic the not plastic straws, et cetera, et cetera. What can we do, if anything? This is a problem that feels way bigger than us, but I know people want to do better. How can they?
Well, there are basic things. I mean, there are, throughout the United States, there are what are called community choice aggregation utilities cropping up. You can actually choose to have a utility that actually provides all its electricity from clean renewable energy, up to 100% of its electricity from wind and solar and geothermal power. So that's an option that a lot of people should take. I mean, and the price of electricity is virtually the same. It's really virtually the same in most places. If it's different, it might be different by 0.01 cents per kilowatt hour, just a tiny amount. So that's one thing. But then you could also power your own home. So a lot of people are putting solar on their own roofs, batteries in their garages. And anything in your home that uses gas, such as a stove, go to induction cooktop stoves. I mean, they're amazing. They boil water in half the time as a gas stove, even. In terms of cars, go to electric cars. I mean, their range is now 300 miles and more. And weatherizing your home, making sure you don't have losses of heat. Energy efficiency is the cheapest form of energy savings.
I'm going to keep these things in mind, Mark, as I am now shopping for appliances myself. So I appreciate right. that. Mark Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and the director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. And Megan Mullen is an associate professor of environmental politics at Duke University. Thanks to you both.
Well, thanks for having us on the show.
And we want to hear from you. With the midterms just weeks away, do you consider climate change a top voting issue? Why or why not?
I'm Terry, and I'm from out here in Oregon. Climate change is always a priority when voting. I have a daughter that works in climate science, and the newest UN reports prove that Trump and his cronies are absolutely wrong. We need more science, more help, more support, more planning for the inevitable that climate change is bringing us. Our paradigms must change.
Hi, this is Milt Lee from Cass Lake, Minnesota. Climate change is number one, first, and always. If we don't deal with climate change, what else is there?
Hi, this is Leanne from Central Illinois. My number one issue in November would be term limits. My number two issue is money and lobbying, and to focus on guns or the environment or abortion or any of the other hot issues would be to ignore the forest.
This is Jim from Walterboro, South Carolina. There's nothing we humans can do about the climate change anyway. Scientists are wrong with this fact. Mother Nature has already started her adjustments, and things will be changing.
Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE to weigh in or tweet us at The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.